But perhaps there will be other kisses. Perhaps they will stretch my beautiful one upon his back on the ground, your hands and feet made fast with brazen clamps, and heap firewood on your body, and light it, so that with tortures for which there is no name, and you alone can know them, gasping and shrieking, while the others only look on, your body is consumed to charcoal by lingering flame. So may it be, beloved. Or perhaps they will put you living in a pit, together with two great dogs, and cover it with beams and earth. And again, no one thinks, nor yourself until it come to pass, what shall happen there below among you three. Do you know of the punishment of the Mortis and Tenon? For being accused by me, and thereupon condemned, you would be shrieking and praying for mercy with the iron rod in your eye and the door grinding your head whenever it pleased the Avenger to pass through. These, then, are but a few of the punishments you are certain to find if I give voice to my complaint, as I am in my last despair resolved to do, for you will not be able to make yourself white after my oath. Out of pity for yourself, O Sarsif, give me your wreath. My friend and mistress, he answered her, you are right. I shall not be able to make myself white, if it please you so to blacken me before my master. But among the punishments with which you threaten me, Petipre must choose. He cannot visit me with all, but only with one, which limits his revenge and my suffering. And even so, my suffering can only comprise what is humanly possible, and whether those limits be small or great, it cannot overpass them, for they are finite. Delight and suffering, both you have painted to me as measureless, but you exaggerate, for with both one soon reaches the limits of human capacity. It is only the error which I should commit that would be measureless, if I destroyed myself in the sight of God the Lord, whom you do not know, so that you cannot tell what it is to be forsaken of God. Therefore, my child, can I not yield to your desire? Woe to that wisdom of yours, she cried in her singing voice. Woe to it! I am not wise. Unwise am I, out of my measureless longing for your flesh and blood, and I will do what I say. I am the loving Isis, and my gaze is death. Take care, O Sarsif. Take care. The lady's party. Ah, how splendid she seemed, our moot, standing before him and threatening him in her bell-like voice. And yet she was weak and helpless like a child, quite without regard for her dignity or her saga. She had of late begun to confide her passion to all the world, and the misery she suffered because of her young man. It had come to this, that now not only Tabubu, the rubber-eater, and Mek-en-Weset, the concubine, were initiated into her love and longing, but also Renenutet, the wife of Amun's overseer of bulls, as well as Neit-Emhet, the wife of Pharaoh's head washerman, and Awera, spouse of Kakabu, the scribe of the silver houses, from the king's silver house. In short, all her friends, all the court, and half the city. It was a distinct sign of her degeneration that toward the end of the third year of her passion, she told everybody without restraint or embarrassment, and imparted to all the world, regardless, that which in the beginning she had so proudly and shyly kept hidden in her own bosom, that she would sooner have died than confess it to the beloved himself or to anyone else. Yes, it was not only the worthy Dudu who degenerates in this story. Moot, the mistress, did too. So much that she lost her manners and her self-control. She was a person deeply afflicted and possessed, entirely beside herself, no longer a denizen of the civilized world and estranged from its standards, a runner upon the mountains, ready to offer her breasts to wild beasts, a garlanded, panting, exulting swinger of the thyrsus. To what all did she not finally descend? This is not the place to speak of the magic she abased herself to practice with Black Tabubu, We shall come to that later. Here we must only note, with mingled amazement and pity, that she prattled everywhere of her love and unslaked longing, restraining herself before neither high nor low, so that soon her affliction was the daily talk of all the household. And the cooks, as they stirred the pots and plucked the fowls, the gatekeepers on their bench, said to each other, "The mistress is keen on the young steward, but he won't hear to it. What a state of things!" For that is the form such subjects take in the heads and on the lips of ordinary folk, by virtue of the lamentable contradiction between the lover's own consciousness of his sacred, serious, painfully beautiful passion, and the impression it makes on the detached observer, to whom its lack of purpose or power to conceal itself is a mockery and a scandal, like a drunken man on the street. All the later versions of our story, with exception of the briefest but most prized, the Koran, as well as the 17 Persian songs, the poem of Firdausi the Disillusioned, on which he spent his old age, and Dashami's late and subtle version, all of these, as well as countless renderings by pencil and brush, tell of the lady's party, which Potiphar's chief and true wife gave to the high society of No-Amun to acquaint them with her suffering and its cause, to arouse sympathy and also envy in the bosoms of her sisters. For love, however unslaked, is not only a curse and a scourge, but also a priceless treasure which one cannot bear to keep hidden. The songs contain some errors, and are guilty of superfluous variations and adornments, which, despite their sweetness and charm, are a burden upon the simple truth. But as for the episode of the lady's party, there they are in the right. And if again, for the sake of pleasing effect, they depart from the original form of the story, or even belie each other by their variations, yet the singers are not the inventors of this event. The story invented it. Or rather, it was the personal invention of Potiphar's wife, poor Aene, who made it up and put it into effect with a shrewdness which stands in the strangest, though most realistic, contradiction to her bemused state. We who know the revelatory dream dreamed by Mut-Em-Enet at the beginning of the 3 years of her love can easily understand the connection between it and the ingenious, pathetic device she employed to open the eyes of her friends. And the dream, which bears every mark of genuineness, is the best evidence for the historicity of the lady's party, and makes quite clear that only laconic brevity of style is responsible for its omission from our nearest and best prized source. As a prelude to the lady's party, Mut-Em-Enet fell ill. Of that illness, in its nature not very well defined, which seizes all the young princes and the king's daughters in the fairy stories when they love unhappily, and which regularly mocks the skill of the most famous physicians. She sickened of it, according to all the rules, because it was the right and proper thing, and the right and proper thing is hard to resist. But also it was important to her, and seems in general to be a principal motive of all these illnesses of princes and king's daughters, to attract attention, to put the world about her in a flutter of excitement, and to be questioned, this above all, to be importuned, as in a matter of life and death, and from all sides. For her changed appearance had for a long time now been the subject of genuine anxiety and question in her closer circle. She fell ill out of the urgency of her need to preoccupy the world with her affliction, with the bliss and torment of her love for Joseph. That there was not much more, literally and strictly speaking, in her illness than this, is shown from the fact that when there was question of a lady's party, Mut could arise from her couch and play the hostess. And no wonder she could, for it was all part of the same plan. So then she fell ill, seriously, if rather indeterminately, and lay abed. She was treated by two eminent doctors, one from Amun's bookhouse, who had previously been called to Montcaw, and another learned man from the temple, cared for by her sisters of the house of the secluded ones, Petipre's concubines, and visited by her friends of the Order of Hathor and Amun's southern house of women. The Lady Renenutet called, Neit Emhet, Awera, and many others. Came too in her litter Nes-Ba-Met, head of the order, consort of the great Beknekons, head priest of all the gods of Upper and Lower Egypt. And all of them, singly or by twos and threes, sat by her bed, mourned over and importuned her in a flood of words, partly from their hearts, but partly also in cold blood, out of pure convention, or even envy. "Eni, with beloved voice when you sing," said they, "in the name of the Hidden One, say what ails you, and how, naughty girl, can you so distress us? As the king lives, you are changed, for a long time now. All of us, in whose hearts you live, have seen the signs of fatigue, and alterations, too, which, while doing no violence to your beauty, give us great concern. May there be no evil eye upon you. We have seen, and wept among ourselves to see, how weariness overtook your body, and a decrease of flesh that attacked not all parts at once, for some are fuller while others have shrunk. Your cheeks, for instance, are gaunt, your eyes begin to stare, and suffering sits upon your much-praised sinuous mouth. We, your admirers, have seen all this and spoken of it with tears, but now your exhaustion has reached a point where you take to your bed and can neither eat nor drink, while your ailment mocks the doctor's art. Truly, at this news, we knew not where we were, so great was our alarm. We have besieged with questions the wise men from the bookhouse, Tahor and Pete Bastet, your physicians, and they have answered they are almost at the end of their skill and will soon be helpless. They had only a few more remedies, which might avail, for all those they have tried have been unavailing. It must be some great affliction that gnaws at you as a mouse will gnaw at the root of a tree so that it sickens. In Amun's name, our treasure, is it true, say? Have you a gnawing sorrow? Tell it quickly to us who love you before the accursed thing strikes at the root of sweet life itself. Supposing, Eni answered in a faint voice, that I had, what good could it do me to name it to you? All your kindness and sympathy could not free me from it, and in all likelihood nothing remains to me but to die. Then it is true, cried they. It is really such a sorrow that is wearing you down. And they expressed their shrill-voiced surprise. How could it be possible, a woman like her, belonging to the highest society, rich, enchantingly lovely, the envied of all others of her sex, what could she lack? What heart's desire was denied her? Mut's friends could simply not understand. They questioned her persistently, partly in the goodness of their hearts, and partly out of sheer curiosity, envy, and love of excitement. For a long time she evaded their questions. In her feeble, hopeless tones, she refused them all information, saying they could do her no good. But at last, very well, she said, she would answer them. She would answer them all together, and make an occasion of it. She would give a ladies' party very soon, and invite them all. She was very weak and without appetite, could scarcely take anything, at most a bird's liver, and a little vegetable. But she would try to find strength to get up, so that she might reveal to her friends the cause of her disordered and altered state.